My guest James Toback directed the new documentary Tyson about the former world heavyweight champion Mike Tyson. Toback's films usually reflect his obsessions with masculinity, race, sex, gambling, and the meaning of life. His films include The Pickup Artist, Harvard Man, The Big Bang, and Black and White, which featured Tyson. Let's start with a clip from Tyson in which Tyson's talking about the period of his life after reform school, when the famous boxing trainer Cus D'Amato took him in and became his guardian, trainer, and mentor.
So I was staying at Cus' house. You know, I come from a really poverty-stricken area, and then when I came to live with Cus, they live in a 14-room Victorian mansion. And I first come here, I said, wow, I could rob these white guys. He's being hip, not thinking. I'm not knowing this guy been around the world a bunch of times. I never knew he was like me. He was from a bad neighborhood. He was a street kid like me. And then one day he used to just say, listen, you have the chance to change your life, your family's life. You could be something very special. Don't you want to be champion? You could be champion of the world. And I didn't pay no attention to it. He said, really? You could be champion of the world. You could devastate the world. No man could take what you did. You just got to believe it. I looked at this guy, and then I started thinking. I said, you really? I said, this guy's really crazy. That's what I said, this guy's crazy. He said, you do what I tell you to do, and if it doesn't work, then you could leave. So I said, okay, bet. So I did everything he told me to do, and I won every championship. From the amateur championship, I won all the championships. I'm gonna cry. So I won every championship that he told me, because he told me what to do.
It's an excerpt of James Toback's new documentary, Tyson. James Toback, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, one of the things that really fascinated me about this film, people have always made fun of how Mike Tyson talked, and I, who never really followed either boxing or Mike Tyson's career, I just assumed Tyson would sound really stupid if I heard him talking. And he's actually a really good speaker. And I guess you knew that about him when you decided to make the film. You knew that he was very articulate.
I knew that from the first night I met him when he was 19, and we walked through Central Park for an hour. I'd met him on the set of The Pickup Artist, and we talked and talked and walked and talked, and I was amazed at how fresh and direct and free of jargon his language was, and how intellectually curious he was. And one of the things that fascinated me was how open he was to any new ideas, any new way of looking at things. When I talked about my LSD flip out when I was a sophomore at Harvard when I was 19, which was his age then, he was absolutely obsessed with finding out what I meant by madness and saying that I'd gone insane. What does it mean to go insane? What does it mean to lose the self? How can you lose the self if your body is still there? How can you say that the I doesn't exist? In fact, the curiosity was so intense that I assumed that at some point in the future he would be susceptible to an episode not unlike that himself. And indeed, after 19 months in prison, years later, we remained friends during that time leading up to his incarceration. He said that all of a sudden he realized, lying in his 6-by-8-foot cell in the corner, that he was now experiencing what Toback had told him about when he was 19 years old, and announced to himself that he was now insane.
He talks about that a little in your documentary.
Yeah.
What was your goal when you made this movie? What did you want to get to about Tyson as a boxer and as a man?
Well, he himself said when I showed him the movie for the first time, it's like a Greek tragedy. The only problem is I'm the subject. And I think he has had a tragic life in the classical sense, that is to say, starting from nothing with an overwhelmingly improbable and hugely successful rise, then a catastrophic fall and crash triggered by his own hubris, his own megalomania, his own grandiosity. And then it's really a double tragedy, because the same dynamic repeats itself. He comes out of prison, regains the two championships, has himself reestablished as this icon, and then again crashes. And I thought that this is a inherently tremendously dramatic story.
When you shot the interviews that you used for your documentary about Mike Tyson, he was in rehab, right?
He was. He was in rehab. And in fact, had he not been in rehab, I doubt whether we would have been able to do the movie.
Why?
Well, because rehab enabled him, first of all, to open himself to one of the many sides of his personality, which is to say the self-analytical meditative side. So he was in an environment which helped to keep that as the current predominant reality. He has many other realities that are more fragmented. And also because it meant that I knew he was going to be in one place at the time that I needed him. Otherwise, Mike tends to travel.
So you're saying, like, if he was hanging out with his entourage during the time that you were shooting the movie, he maybe wouldn't have been so introspective?
Maybe not so reliably concentrated in his appearances. I mean, when we shot black and white, I used them in black and white, and great scene with Downey and Brooke Shields, and then another scene after that. He did exactly what I asked him to do, and we shot it over a two-day period. But had I asked him for 10 hours a day for 5 days, I don't think that would have been remotely possible.
Is that what you shot, 10 hours a day for 5 days?
With this movie, yes.
So what did the people who were running the rehab facility where he was he like living in the facility or just going?
He was living in the rehab facility.
So they had no objections to you coming in and
No,
and
they didn't. I think they felt it would be very good for him and therapeutic, as indeed I think it was, because he has a confessional nature, and this was a chance in a sort of quasi-psychoanalytic environment to get back into the recesses of his consciousness and articulate a lot of the things that had been buried.
So how did you get him talking? What was your interviewing style like?
It was psychoanalytic as opposed to therapeutic. It wasn't question-answer. It was suggestion and then allowing him to go on for 40 minutes with two cameras running with no response on my part. I was standing behind him, so he couldn't even see me. And I, for instance, at the very beginning said, so what are your earliest memories? And then I shot for 40 minutes while he responded. Probably 15 of those minutes or so involved his talking, some of it absolutely stunning, with some interruptions, but maybe a good 60% of the time he was silent. And we got a lot of great facial shots, reactions, because he was thinking and you can read his mind while he's thinking.
Why were you standing behind him? Didn't you want him looking at you?
No.
So he'd have something to focus on?
No, I wanted him to feel the way someone engaged in a deep psychoanalysis feels, which is that his voices are coming out and provoked by some mysterious voice behind him. When I was in psychoanalysis in my 20s with Gustav Bischofsky, a famous Polish analyst, I found myself saying things for the first 3 or 4 months that shocked me. In fact, I used to jump off the couch and say, I didn't mean that, after most of what I said, and he would sit there and shrug. But I know that I never would have come out with that stuff if I'd been sitting facing him.
So you didn't want him to see you. So how did you even know? Did you have a monitor to see what he was looking like when he was talking to the camera?
I did not see his face at all when I was talking, no.
So you were surprised whenever you'd go and look at the rushes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I knew his face well enough to know that I was getting a lot of great stuff. And Larry McConkie, the cinematographer, was telling me, you know, after each long, long, long take, you know, we got some great stuff here. But I was much more interested in creating a climate in which he could allow himself to liberate these buried voices and have them come out and say the things that he otherwise never would have said.
Compare how you see Tyson in the ring and out of the ring. Because, you know, I mean, in the ring, he's really fierce. And out of the ring, he has a reputation for being fierce with women. The fierce side of him wasn't coming out when you were shooting him. But you've hung around with him a lot over the years. Do you see him as, like, having a lot of different personalities?
Many, many personalities. He's got multiple voices, multiple personalities, and his shifts are mercurial and unpredictable. And I think that...
Give us an example of some time you've seen him make a shift like that surprised you.
Well, you know, just even in the last few weeks as we've done some interviews together, he either can be slightly sullen and uninterested in talking at all and seems to want to just get it over with and not really want to talk about himself. Or he can get very animated and laugh a lot and feel as if he's having a great time and be very open and communicative. And those shifts can be almost as sudden as happening in the middle of a sentence.
You know, in terms of his different personalities, during his life he's been both like the weakling and the boxing champion. You know, he talks about he was a fat kid, he was bullied as a kid, he didn't know how to fight. And it wasn't until he was in prison, you know, in juvie when he was like 13, that he learned how to punch.
That's right. He talks about his first punch being landed when he was younger than that. I think when he was about 8 or 9 when he... The bully broke the neck of his pigeon. He used to collect pigeons, and this guy broke the neck of his pigeon, and he knocked the guy down. But basically, he was an asthmatic. He was short, fat, ungainly, and frightened. So he was, on a certain level, the most unlikely person to become heavyweight champion of the world. But it was what he did with those limitations that made him heavyweight champion. He quotes Customato as saying, it's not just the physical strength or the physical force, it's the psychology, it's the mind, it's having the soul of a warrior. It's using your fear to overcome the other person's will and convert and transmute your fear into him and infect him with it and take the suffering that you've had and the limitations you've had and become intimidating and triumphant by transcending those weaknesses and fears and using them.
And that's one of the interesting contradictions about Tyson. He seems to have gotten his trainer Customato's message about, you know, as he puts it, the more kind of spiritual aspects of the fight and the importance of building character when you're a fighter. But outside the ring, didn't necessarily get the message.
Well, that's the thing. That was incomplete education. Cuss sort of ran an almost military school type environment in which certain disciplines were stressed rigorously, but the psychology... that was needed to deal with the outside world in a way that did not involve boxing was left conspicuously absent.
Some of the greatest disasters in his life involved women, and he talks about them in the movie. And, you know, the two specific women I'm thinking of are Robin Givens, to whom he was briefly married, who accused him of abusing her, and then Desiree Washington, the Miss Black America contestant, who... filed charges against him, criminal charges for raping her, and he was convicted for rape and deviant sexual behavior and was sentenced to a maximum of 10 years and spent 3 in prison. And he basically denies a lot of this.
I mean, I think anyone who looks at that case would be at the very least highly suspicious of the accusations.
You're talking about Desiree Washington here.
Yeah, I mean, Robin Givens is sort of all over the place in the things she says, and Mike actually speaks much more fondly of her than she does of him. But anyone who announces about her husband that she's scared of him and he is abusive on national television. In effect, she was announcing that she was going to divorce him on national television, which struck me as a bit self-promotional.
What you're referring to here is a very kind of bizarre interview with Barbara Walters.
Right.
In which
yeah.
she talks about how he seems to be what, manic depressive, that he has these incredible mood swings. And
yeah, she psychoanalyzes him in his presence without having told him she was going to do it in an interview with Barbara Walters. And in fact, Mike sat there shocked and says that the only way he can explain it is that they were hoping that he would behave like a psychopath and start throwing furniture and act crazy, and that it would be dramatic television, good for publicity and good for the ratings of the show. But it certainly doesn't, to me anyway, speak well for Robin Givens as a way of handling a personal problem in what I would regard as a sort of not even tabloid way of exhibition, but more of a almost glaringly self-promotional way. The Desiree Washington case was one in which you know, who knows? Everybody, the only two people who know what happened between two people is the two people who were there. I wasn't there, so I don't know. But I do know that Mike over the years has insisted to me when we've talked privately that it was a complete lie, not an ambiguous case, not I guess there's a way that she might have thought this, or but just an out-and-out lie.
Is he saying that it's a lie that they had sex and rough sex, or is he just saying it's a lie that it wasn't consensual?
Yeah, a lie that it was rough. It was apparently, in his case, not even remotely rough, not even he said at one point to me, he said, if that was rape, then every act of sex I've ever had with every person I've ever had sex with was rape. He said that I've never had a sexual act that wasn't rape.
Let me quote something our film critic David Edelstein says about the film, about Tyson. He says, yeah. Tyson is candid, though not detailed or specific, about his mistreatment of women, but he still maintains he was wrongly convicted of rape. And on the basis of this movie, I believe he believes that. But I also believe he had no way of knowing back then what a woman wanted or didn't want. He had zero capacity for empathy and way too much power. What do you think of what Edelstein says?
Well, I think that that, you know, he certainly had a hugely expansive and self-centered notion of life. And to be in that position when he was 19 and 20, where the world is getting parades for him in Moscow and being worshipped around the world, it would be hard for that not to go to the head of a kid in that case, and it certainly went to his head. He talks rather shockingly and originally about what he wants in women and what his relationship to women has been in the movie. It's kind of very uninhibitedly bold. I would say that women come on to Mike on a ratio of about 50 to 1 as opposed to his coming on to them. I mean, if you spend any time around Mike, women are chasing him and pursuing him, not the other way around. But, you know, this the rape case, he had a tax lawyer from Washington, D.C. representing him in an Indiana court with an Indiana judge and an Indiana prosecutor who were friendly with an all-white jury. With a black guy from Brooklyn accused of rape. You know, and to say convicted rape, I mean, rape is obviously an atrocious and unpardonable crime, but to say convicted rapist, the word convicted means nothing. I mean, who thinks that because someone is convicted, he's guilty? It's like saying O.J. Simpson was an innocent murderer. Who thinks O.J. Simpson was innocent just because an all-black jury found him innocent?
Well, that doesn't throw out every single conviction
or
claim of innocence ever made, you know.
Of course it doesn't, but it doesn't mean that conviction means guilty. And what conviction, when people say he's a convicted this or that, the assumption is that convicted means guilty, because when the word convicted means that 12 people said, we think he's guilty, and maybe they're right. I mean, who knows what the percentage is, but we all know that people have been sent to death when they didn't commit murders, that people have been rotting away on death row when DNA has proved that they didn't commit murders.
Let me get back to something you said about Tyson's, the rape case. You said he had a tax attorney for his lawyer. How did he end up with a tax attorney?
Don King picked him.
Oh, because Don King was managing Tyson then.
That's correct.
And Tyson has a very, very low regard for Don King, as he makes
correct.
Clear in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, once one actually studied the
circumstances. Well, he sued him for basically stealing money from him.
Yeah,
Tyson sued King, yeah, and won.
Yeah, and won. I mean, once one actually looks at the circumstances of that case, nobody can come away with the same conclusion you started with, because there are too many things about it that are absolutely unbelievable, where you just say, what? What? How did this happen? How did that happen?
One of the things Tyson is famous for, or infamous for, is having bit his opponent Evander Holyfield's ear twice in one fight. And this was a very famous rematch. And what Tyson says is that Holyfield headbutted him, and he was so angry that he bit him.
Well, you see in the first Holyfield fight that Holyfield is intentionally butting him in the eye and opening a cut. And then Mike warned the referee and said, watch out, because he was afraid Holyfield was again going to try to open that cut with headbutts. And you see very clearly in the movie that he does exactly that. And Mike looks to the referee after he does it twice in a period of 20 seconds. And the referee warns Holyfield the first time, but then ignores Tyson's reminder of what's happened the second time. And he just snaps, and he does a very dramatic voiceover. And actually watching that, I think you sort of feel that he would have been justified in biting a third ear if Holyfield had one. Certainly, he says it's quite startling. He says he has no remorse whatsoever for having bitten the ears. His remorse is for having lost his discipline. He said the fighter is worth anything only to the extent that he has discipline, and that the warrior needs discipline, and he lost his discipline and went crazy in the ring, not just then, but after the ring when he's still trying to get at Holyfield. And I think that's in effect when his career ended, when his love of boxing ended, when his belief in himself as a boxer ended, not because of the ear biting, but because of his complete psychotic response after that.
Were you there for Tyson's final fight?
No, at that point I didn't want to watch him fight. I knew what he was doing. I knew he was just fighting for money. That was humiliating and degrading and not something that I enjoyed watching. And even putting it in the movie, I know it's painful for him to watch. It's also painful for me to watch. I mean, it needs to be in the movie, and you need to see him having him getting beaten up just to make the horror of it felt.
Describe how the fight ended. And this was what, in June 2005?
Yeah, I mean, that the McBride fight, I think my theory is that he secretly, at least unconsciously, wanted to lose because he had a six-fight deal for $80 million if he won the fight. And I don't think he, on any level, he could face with having six more fights after that. And the only way he was going to get out of it was to lose. So I think he literally was hoping he would lose, certainly unconsciously. He cut up McBride. He landed a lot of very strong punches, and actually McBride looks far worse at the end of the fight than Tyson does. But Mike he literally sat down at the end of the sixth round and didn't want to get up. And the referee is basically standing there waiting for him to go up and get back into his corner. And Mike sort of slowly gets up as if to say, I don't even know where I am and I don't care where I am. And then one of his handlers, who was an Australian fighter who loves Mike, just said, that's it. He's not coming out for the seventh round.
And when he talks about calling off the fight, like just ending it, in your movie, he says that, you know, he was just fighting to pay the bills and that he didn't have the fight and the guts anymore.
Yeah, he doesn't have the fighting guts anymore.
And he says, actually, I think this is actually a clip from the Time, an interview from the Time right after the fight. And he said, I'm not an animal anymore. I don't love this anymore.
Right. Right. And he says, I'm sorry I disappointed the fans that paid to see me, but I just don't want to do this anymore. I mean, it was a sad ending and not an atypical one. Boxing is a brutal, brutal sport, and almost everybody ends in a horrible way. Jack Johnson by getting knocked out, John L. Sullivan by getting knocked out, Joe Louis getting knocked through the rings by the ropes by Rocky Marciano, who idolized Joe Louis, and he knocked him right out of the ring. It's a very, very dark, brutal sport.
Your movie ends with Tyson basically on camera not speaking. Like the final few seconds, he's just reflecting and breathing.
And breathing.
And you hear him breathing. he has like a little wheeze in his breath. And
yeah,
we learn early in the film that he had asthma as a child.
That's right.
And did he fight with asthma?
He did, yeah. He fought with bronchial problems, and he says he was always hoping that he could end the fights early because of his breathing problems. And you can imagine what kind of panic he was in as a kid. I was an asthmatic kid, and, you know, you're terrified of these bouts where you can't breathe. You feel as if your head's being held underwater. And I think it always stays with you. I think it's very powerful, informing personality. I think people who've had asthma as a kid, there's never been an adequate understanding of how deep-rooted that fear is and how it carries through the rest of your life. And I think it's one of the key things in seeing Mike Tyson and understanding him, that he was this asthmatic kid. But what happened was when I put my earphones on at the beginning, the first morning of shooting, there he was sitting on the couch, and I hear this. And I looked over thinking, is there something wrong? And I thought, no, he's just sitting there breathing normally. But it wasn't normal breathing. It was labored breathing. And I actually said to myself at that moment, that's what the last sound of the movie is going to be, that breathing. Mm. And we found a great image for it and a great moment for it. It's quite haunting at the end.
Yeah, agreed. Tyson has this famous tattoo on his face. It covers the whole side of his face. And in the movie, he explains that it's a warrior tattoo from the Maori tribe.
Right.
And I'm wondering what that offered to you as a filmmaker. Because the camera is on his face just about the whole time outside of the clips.
Absolutely. It's a great image. I mean, he loves the tattoo, and I think it's a it marks his face in a very distinguished way. And also his other tattoos, which are Mao and Che. You know, he says that he hated America for putting him in prison unjustly when he didn't do what he was convicted for. And his protest against being falsely incarcerated was to have himself tattooed with symbols of anti-American fervor.
So when you were interviewing Mike Tyson for your film, what interested you most in what he had to say about his approach to boxing in terms of how he prepared mentally and what went on in his mind when he was in the ring and just before he went into the ring?
Well, there's a fascinating passage in the movie where he talks about being consumed by fear during training and leading up to a fight, fear of the other fighter, and that only as he's walking towards the ring, the night of the fight, does he start to feel that he can summon up enough ferocity in him to purge himself of the fear and inflict it on the other fighter? And he does it through his eyes, through his gaze, staring at the eyes of the opponent, walking towards the other opponent. And you see it happening as he describes it very dramatically, and it's as if he's looking straight into the terror that he's creating in the other person, and the other fighter looks away, and as soon as he looks away, they both know Tyson's going to knock him out.
He never gave you that look, did he?
No, but as a matter of fact, we were posing for photographs a couple of weeks ago, and the photographers said face each other, and I looked into Tyson's eyes, and he cracked up, and he said, "You would terrify almost anybody with that look."
James Toback, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
James Toback directed the new documentary, Tyson.